We need people who are well-educated enough to know what the Constitution means, what it says, how its principles work.
Dr. Robert George of Princeton University talking about his presentation on the Constitution and civic virtue at this year's virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
We need people who are willing to fight for those principles, to call out politicians, whether they're liberal or conservative, whether they are Democratic or Republican, when they transgress against the Constitution. We need a people who are fit for liberty and fit for the rule of law under a Constitution like ours, a Republican polity like ours, established under the Constitution. So I'm really going to be talking about civic virtue and its relationship to constitutional structures and principles.
You can watch Dr. Robert George's presentation at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. Conference registrants can watch live and on demand. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org. It is called an executive order on advancing international religious freedom. It was signed by President Trump on the 2nd of June, and it will go a long way toward advancing international religious freedom, a thing that, well, our foreign policy for many, many years tended to ignore or at the very least make a very low priority. Why was that? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about this recent executive order on international religious freedom, Nina Shea. She's an international human rights lawyer, senior fellow for the Hudson Institute, and author of a recent column for the Wall Street Journal titled A Big Step for Religious Freedom. Nina, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Todd.
You say that religious freedom has been treated as the unwanted stepchild in human rights on the human rights side of U.S. foreign policy. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that it really has been neglected, that it has been not given the priority treatment we've seen with the human rights of other under other freedoms, such as the human rights of journalists or human rights defenders or trade unionists, even lawyers, you know, have human rights and internationally. And that's part of our foreign policy. And has been really since we signed the Universal Declaration for Human Rights in 1948. In fact, we helped draft it. Religious freedom is part of that document as well, but it was neglected. There are those who thought in our foreign policy circles that it was really not universal, that it was not inalienable, that it was somehow intrusion on someone else's culture, an unpleasant thing to talk about. Maybe they didn't know how to talk about religious freedom. So we established a bureau for human rights back in the 70s, and still it wasn't, that's within the State Department, that still wasn't enough. So in 1998, a broad grassroots movement of different religious leaders formed a coalition and pressed for the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998, and that was signed into law. It was introduced in Congress, by the way, by Congressman Frank Wolf from Virginia. And there is an amendment to that act that came along a decade or so later, two decades later, that strengthened it. Now, what those two laws did was to create an entire infrastructure within the State Department specifically on religious freedom. But not enough to ensure religious freedom's place in U.S. foreign policy.
Tell us about President Trump's June 2 executive order on advancing international religious freedom.
Yeah, well, let me just step back and say that what these other prior laws specifically did on religious freedom was to create a new office on religious freedom within the State Department, an ambassador-at-large position within the State Department, this is a new post, and an annual report on religious freedom in every country in the world, giving the status of religious freedom and identifying the world's worst religious persecutors. Now, U.S. policy was, under those laws, supposed to have some kind of policy response to those governments that we identified, that the State Department identified under those laws as being the world's worst persecutors. They're called countries of particular concern. And yet those policies were either very weak or they didn't happen at all. And that would be true of even the world's worst persecutors, like China or Saudi Arabia, where no churches are allowed at all, no other religions other than Islam. And even the Shia branch of Islam is persecuted in Saudi Arabia. So there was no response from the United States, no policy response. So what the June 2nd executive order does is it's a directive from the chief executive to all the agencies in the government that deal with foreign policy to make religious freedom a priority, to make the advancement of religious freedom a priority in our foreign policy. And it applies not just to the Middle East, but to the whole world, not just to minorities, but to any persecution against any group. So it's quite significant that there are now basically orders for the State Department, U.S. Agency for International Development, and any other agency that is dealing with foreign affairs to take into consideration to vigorously promote religious freedom is the language, to be vigorous about it and to make it a priority. This was followed on a national security strategy report in 2017 under this administration that identified religious freedom, called it a priority, national security priority. So this is a moral and national security imperative for this administration. And now it is not just a pet project of, say, Mr. Pence, who has been quite committed to advancing religious freedom on his own as much as he can, or any other particular officer within the administration. It applies to every ambassador of the United States around the world. All federal employees who deal with foreign policy will now have to go through training so they do learn how to talk about religious freedom and what it means and why it's so central to our other freedoms.
Why do you say that this isn't just a symbolic gesture?
Well, because it is making operational something that has been aspirational. It's implementing the legal language of the past decades. It directs the employees of the administration of the federal government to make this right of religious freedom a priority in policymaking. So it includes, of course, speeches and meetings, which the State Department does very well, but it also includes really in our diplomacy and in our foreign assistance and our foreign aid giving to do very concrete things to promote religious freedom. For example, in Iraq, after ISIS in 2014, that's when ISIS entered Iraq and tried to eradicate all the Yazidis and the Christian minorities. Our aid did not reach them, the survivors of this assault. They were in refugee camps, many of them makeshift. Some of them were camping out in the open. They had no UN camp. There was no UN camp for them. Their leaders had to go around the world begging to get enough food day to day. We sent $2 billion in foreign aid, humanitarian aid, to Iraqi people during that period from 2014 to 2018, and it did not reach them. It went through the UN. The UN did not give it to them. It's that simple. So in 2018, Vice President Pence, it was brought to his attention. He insisted that USAID find a way to get it to them. These minorities, these genocide survivors, really. And because by that time, Secretary of State Kerry in the Obama administration had already designated them as victims of genocide. So they were survivors of genocide for U.S. foreign policy purposes. And finally, 4 years later, they started getting aid. This explicitly addresses that situation and says that these people, you know, minorities who are persecuted should be helped. And that furthermore, local faith-based groups on the ground can receive the funding to help them. Because in those situations, it was their own religious leaders who were taking care of them because the UN did not.
If you could briefly describe American foreign policy and its track record on religious freedom up to this improvement.
Well, that's a tall order to do it briefly. You know, I would say that when the trade would take precedence and national security would take precedence over rights and particularly religious freedom. And what we found is that religious freedom intersects with our trade security, our national security, and that very often we have there's a national security issue with countries that, are severe persecutors of religious freedom. So we have today, in fact, President Trump signed another executive order called the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act to help the Uyghurs in China try to hold accountable their persecutors. So we're beginning to see this now take effect by virtue of this new directive, and this will be a very important step. We should not be selling surveillance equipment, for example, to China when it uses it to persecute Uyghur Muslims and Tibetan Buddhists and Falun Gong and Christians and anybody else who is a religious person over there.
Why do you think that religious freedom was given such a low priority in previous State Departments?
Well, I think that, you know, judging on what has been said, and I have been in this field for over 30 years, so I was working on the International Religious Freedom Act in 1998. I had a front row seat there. I was one of the leaders of it. And I heard at Catholic University Law School a speech given by our Secretary of State at the time, Madeleine Albright, saying that it was in the context of what we were talking about that day, that moment, that year, was repression, terrible repression in Sudan by the government of Sudan. It's changed there, thankfully, just in the last year and a half. But at that time, there was quite a bit of enslavement. There was massive massacres. There was massive rape, mass starvation, forcible starvation against the religious minorities. And the Secretary of State at that time said to this Catholic University law school audience, we don't want to impose our views. We have to respect the views of others, meaning the government of Sudan, these government persecutors, including, you know, a country like Sudan at the time. So it really indicated that they did not believe or buy into the fact that this was a universal human right, that this was somehow, you know, a cultural particularity of Americans, and it was American value, and they had other values, and we should respect them, even when those values were to persecute people because of their belief in God and how they worshiped.
What does the U.S. State Department need to do specifically to advance international religious freedom?
Well, I think it's very important to, one, get the facts right. And it really needs to start meeting with minorities and those who have really egregious cases to find out what is behind it, what's going on, whether it is a religious issue. For example, right now in Nigeria, our State Department Religious Freedom Report just came out. There is a terrible persecution going on against the Christians in Nigeria. They're about half the population there, so they're not really a minority. But there are extremists there. There's terror groups, Boko Haram. It's linked to ISIS. There are about 24 beheadings of Christians over Christmas period. There's a Fulani extremists, which is another Islamic group that is now becoming radicalized. We're seeing that. That is not even mentioned as a religious problem. It's in the current report that just came out a week ago by the State Department. It's considered a fight over natural resources. Now, many of these religious issues, especially societal hostility like this situation is, involves land or resources. But when your churches are burned by the hundreds, when your religious leaders are attacked and killed and targeted, when hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, thousands of people are driven from their land, when there's these egregious attacks against children and women, chopping them up into little pieces with machetes, it's more than a fight over land. This is not happening in the context of a battle. This is a raid at night on a Christian village. and village after village after village. It's been going on for several years. It's something new to them. They used to live side by side, and this is a new phenomenon, and it's part of what we're seeing for those of us who study this as a radicalization within the region. And it's very alarming. It's another example of how our own self-interest to have Africa's most important country, largest economy, largest population, a regional influencer, a country like Nigeria, see this go on, and we're totally blind to it, is very problematic. So it starts with a good database, it starts with good facts, honest reporting, and then it goes from there to how we can help the Nigerian government ensure that this stops, that there is a peaceful way to resolve whatever problems there are, and there is protection and prosecution for these heinous acts before it gets to the point of religious genocide.
Finally then, Nina, why is religious freedom a foreign policy issue and indeed a priority?
Well, it's a foreign policy issue because it is in our Bill of Rights and it's our values. It's part of America's character. We helped shape the international order where the Universal Declaration for Human Rights upholds and enshrines religious freedom as a basic human right, along with freedom of expression, along with equality on the basis of gender and race and religion. So, I mean, there are all sorts of rights, and religious freedom is almost our identification as Americans. I think we have a very unique system where religions do not have to be registered. Yes, they have to be registered for tax purposes, but there's not one Christian group, for example, that says, okay, you are the Christian group, or you're that represents the entire religion vis-a-vis the government, or that you have to have a certain number of members and congregants to be able to assemble, or that certain religions can't meet and have houses of worship. That's very unusual in this world, even in the West. And so we do have to uphold it at home, and we should reflect it as part of our foreign policy. Our foreign policy, we've never, for decades, we have rejected as a country the notion that our foreign policy is only for our economic goals or our military goals. It's for also to sharing our values and our democracy.
Nina Shea is an international human rights lawyer, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, and author of a recent column for the Wall Street Journal titled A Big Step for Religious Freedom. You'll find a link to this column and to the Hudson Institute at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Nina, thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd.
I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
The Simply Classical curriculum for special needs moves at my child's pace and gives her exactly what she needs. So writes Amber, a homeschooling mother who has joined thousands in homes and schools teaching from this uniquely Christian classical approach to special education. Teach students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome based on ability level rather than chronological age. Use promo code LPR20 today at classicalspecialneeds.com. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Our life together as the church after COVID-19 will bring new challenges. For example, we might be tempted to skip the regular gathering of God's people because we're more comfortable streaming it on Facebook instead. May it not be. Join the Reverend Dr. Mark Wood as he explores this theme in his article for the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness titled, Gathering Again, It Will Not Be the Same. Subscribe at cph.org/witness, The Lutheran Witness, Interpreting the Contemporary World from a Lutheran Perspective, cph.org/witness.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union serves the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod community with car and personal loans, mortgages, credit cards, checking and savings accounts. Lutheran FCU supports LCMS organizations with its Spotlight Ministry program, and Lutheran Federal Credit Union allows you to make purchases with Apple Pay, Google Pay, and Samsung Pay using your digital wallet. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Good for you, good for the church, Lutheran Federal Credit Union, LutheranFCU.org.